full show for you today. Remember the financial crisis of 2008 when the shenanigans of Wall Street and the megabanks nearly crashed the global economic order? Remember the unfolding horror of families being put out on the streets, their possessions on their former front lawns? Remember the swift billions of taxpayer dollars handed over to banks that were too big to fail? And the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars quickly paid in bonuses to those very perpetrators who were too big to jail? Or as Matt Taibbi puts it, too smug to jail? Recent government figures put the cost at more than $20 trillion to the U.S. economy. But how can one reckon the cost in human suffering? The soaring unemployment, the wiping out of retirement savings, the suicides, the massive transfer of wealth from the middle class and the most needy to the least needy? Remember President Obama telling the nation that while what they did, quote, was just immoral or inappropriate or reckless, a lot of that stuff wasn't necessarily illegal, end of quote. Well, our guest for the full hour is Stephen A. Ramirez, law professor and associate dean for research and faculty development, and director of the Business and Corporate Governance Law Center at Loyola University School of Law. He and his wife, Mary Kreiner Ramirez, who is a law professor at Washburn University School of Law, have co-written an eye-opening book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street, just published by New York University Press. In it, they lay out precisely and in great depth how and why criminal charges can and should be brought for the fraud and malfeasance perpetrated on the American public, and indeed nearly destroying the world economic order. And yet not a single senior executive has been indicted on any criminal charges, although ample evidence was provided to the Department of Justice and other agencies with the power to penalize wrongdoing. As they note, in many cases, the statute of limitations has not run out. Professor Ramirez is well qualified to establish this, since he served as a senior attorney for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, as well as an enforcement attorney with the Securities and Exchange Commission. He has published extensively in the areas of law and economics, corporate governance, and financial regulations. In addition to this latest book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street, his books include Lawless Capitalism, The Subprime Crisis and the Case for an Economic Rule of Law, and The Economics of Discrimination, in the Encyclopedia of Law and Society. But without further ado, we welcome you to Forthright Radio, Professor Stephen A. Ramirez.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here today.
Well, we're very glad to have you. Professor Ramirez, you write that, quote, the government's explanation for the lack of prosecutions is incoherent and unprincipled. From an historic point of view, the lack of prosecutions is also inexplicable, and that this failure to pursue any of the manifest criminal misconduct amounts to an historic breakdown in the rule of law without any colorable justification, end of quote. Please tell us, what is the norm historically and as recently as the George W. Bush administration?
Well, start with the savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s, early 1990s. There was a large amount of government activity, both criminally and civilly, against the people who were responsible for the losses suffered as a result of the savings and loan crisis. The numbers are hard to pin down, but certainly it's the case that scores of criminal cases were brought. Convictions were obtained, and people who were very well connected politically were pursued criminally by the Department of Justice, including most famously, I think, Charles Keating, who had very close connections with a number of U.S. senators. So I think that's sort of the baseline, is the very active criminal prosecutorial function that we saw during the savings and loan crisis. And that crisis really was not as severe as the financial crisis of 2007-2008. It didn't cause the same kind of macroeconomic damage. There weren't as many victims. The financial sector did not need as much money in terms of bailouts. And also, I think that it's fair to say that we have much more evidence in this more recent crisis of fraudulent activity. There's a jury finding, for example, that a mid-level manager at Goldman Sachs committed securities fraud. There's hundreds of billions of dollars in settlements that have been paid. And it's hard to conceive that in light of these facts, that there would be virtually zero criminal actions against any of the major banks on Wall Street, the most powerful financial institutions in our history. You can go beyond the savings and loan crisis, and you can talk about Enron. I think here, the person who is the best example of how the rule of law ought to work is Ken Lay. So Ken Lay was very close to the Bush family. He was very close to the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. And yet, the Department of Justice went after Ken Lay. They secured a jury finding that Ken Lay committed fraud. A number of people at Enron ended up being criminally convicted. And that's sort of how the system has worked during sort of post-World War II modern capitalism in the United States, is that really no one was above the law when it came to white-collar crime. Then all of a sudden comes these huge banks with more influence than anyone's ever seen before in terms of how connected they are to Washington and the politics. And all of a sudden, you know, the DOJ guns fall silent. Very odd, very difficult to explain, hard to find a coherent explanation.
And just to be clear, not only were the individuals in the cases you mentioned convicted, but they actually were convicted and sentenced to prison terms. You didn't mention WorldCom, but Ken Lay, he actually died before he was able to serve his time. But Jeff Skilling, who was convicted in the Enron fiasco, he was convicted of 14 years in a federal penitentiary. And as I understand it, he's actually still in prison. Is that correct?
I think that is correct. Jeff Skilling and Dennis Kozlowski both ended up in jail. And again, I think that that illustrates both of those folks are certainly financial titans. I just don't think that those kinds of individuals had the same degree of economic and political power that the chieftains of Wall Street now have.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the book that you wrote with your wife, Mary, is it Kreiner Ramirez?
Yes, Mary Kreiner Ramirez.
Okay. The case for the corporate death penalty. You hold up these criminal convictions as examples that would inhibit, if not actually prohibit, malfeasance and fraud and those sorts of things. And yet, it seems that they didn't really serve effectively anyway because of. Give us some examples of the actions that occurred leading up to the financial collapse of 2008.
Well, I think that the incentives were distorted on a systemic basis. I think that the financial sector had achieved such a level of power that they were able to subvert law and regulation in their favor on a systemic basis. And I wrote a book on this called Lawless Capitalism. That book was written much earlier in the aftermath of the crisis, and it focused on the period of the years leading up to the subprime debacle, and it focused on the subversion of legal and regulatory infrastructure leading up to the subprime debacle. And I think what it really comes down to is, you know, there was an effort to regulate derivatives. It was a rational effort. It was led by Brooks Lyborn, and it got shot down by people who were more connected to the financial sector than she was. And there's been a lot written on that, and it was a real shame because it's possible that if the derivatives part of this crisis had been subject to rational regulation, that maybe the crisis could have been averted altogether, but certainly it would have been greatly diminished. I think another problem was the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, not because investment banking and commercial banking can't mix. I think that's a problem. But I think a far larger problem is that Glass-Steagall's repeal paved the way for a series of mergers and acquisitions that really led to these mega banks that we'd never seen before in American history. And the concentration of power in the financial sector following the repeal of Glass-Steagall is just mind-boggling. So that's a problem. I think another problem was that we passed an act in the 1990s called the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. And the Reform Act was no reform whatsoever. Instead, it was a giveaway to securities fraud feasors, and it just made it irrationally difficult to sue people for securities fraud. And private litigation is important because private litigation is not subject to political power. Most private class action attorneys simply do not care if the people they sue are Democrats or Republicans. They're in business to make money. All they care about is the merits of the case. So once we took away private securities litigation and watered it down and diluted it to a shadow of its former self, we were only left with the SEC and the DOJ, the Department of Justice, to enforce the securities laws. And unfortunately, those are government agencies, and government agencies can be politically co-opted. So there was a problem there. I think another problem that we had was the deregulation of the mortgage market. When I worked at the FDIC, most mortgage lending went through the banks. The banks were highly regulated and could only approve certain loans, usually 20% loan-to-value ratios in terms of down payment. Usually they had to be very careful in terms of securing appraisals. Banks were required to do very careful loan underwriting. When we deregulated the mortgage market, we really opened up a Pandora's box that explains how all of these really rotten loans from 2005, 2006, and especially early 2007 came to be. So it makes sense, doesn't it, that if the original thesis of lawless capitalism was that instead of being subject to the law, the bankers became above the law, that they would also conduct themselves in a way that skirted traditional prohibitions against fraud, bank fraud, mail fraud, wire fraud, and sure enough, they did. And then, to add insult to injury and to create problems moving forward, the government sat on its hands.
We're speaking with Professor Stephen A. Ramirez about his book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. Now, Professor Ramirez, one could get the impression from what you just talked about, the changing in the laws of Glass-Steagall and the deregulation allowing the banks to merge and less scrutiny and regulations on mortgage lending. But in your book, you and your wife go into great detail talking about laws that Congress has in fact passed over the years still apply that should have prevented and can prosecute for some of the more egregious frauds that were committed. Before we go into those laws, let's talk about some of the specifics of the fraud. And if it's not too exaggerated, the case that can be made for conspiracy to skirt the existing laws.
Yeah, so I think if you were going to look at the most egregious instances of fraud that have been uncovered so far in the financial crisis inquiries that occurred in the aftermath of the crisis, I think you'd have to start with the civil jury trial verdict of securities fraud against Fabrice Touré, who was a mid-level manager at Goldman Sachs, in connection with an investment vehicle known as Abacus. I think you'd have to talk about Countrywide and the high-speed swim lane program that they put in place in the immediate aftermath of the crash of the subprime mortgage, whereby they basically skirted requirements and obligations that they had to underwrite loans of certain quality before selling them to secondary investors like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the FHA. I think you would have to add in sort of the various revelations that have been provided by whistleblowers like Elaine Fleischman at Chase, or some mortgage managers at Citigroup, who basically said that the banks knew they were not underwriting these loans well. They knew that these loans were very risky loans, and nevertheless, they pawned them off on the investing public as prime loans. I mean, right there, you're probably talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in toxic loans that were peddled as prime mortgages. And I think this is a key point that every American should understand. It wasn't a case of people who were taking out subprime loans and weren't able to make their payments. Really, the key thing, that was known by the banks. They saw that one coming. What people didn't see coming was that the banks would package those loans and peddle them as prime loans instead of toxic high-risk loans. That became a very profitable business model, and as a result, it led to windfall compensation for high-level senior executives at places like Countrywide, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, across the board.
Let's step back just a moment and examine that. You mentioned the Citigroup high-speed swim lane, the acronym for which was HUSTLE.
I can't imagine
a more ironic and descriptive acronym for what was really going on. The sheer volume of these subprime, and let's talk about what is subprime versus prime loan.
Well, there's no really clear definition between subprime and prime. I like to think of prime loans as conforming loans, 20% buyer down payment. The loan doesn't exceed 80% of loan to value. You've got a credit score in the 700s. I mean, these are the loans that you have a very, very high degree of certainty will perform and will be paid back. And Fannie and Freddie specialize in that part of the market. That's what they do. They buy loans from the banking industry and they sell them to investors worldwide, and they're conforming loans. Fannie and Freddie invested in subprime loans, but they did not originate or distribute subprime loans. And so really, that part of the market never really, there was never any problem with that part of the market. What happened in 2005, 2006, 2007, is our financial sector really went crazy with very high-risk mortgages that they were able to produce in very high volume, largely by being predatory lenders on those without the sophistication or the experience to understand the loans they were entering into, and then turning around and selling those loans prime loans when, in fact, they were very risky loans. They were even toxic in some cases. And the high-speed swim lane was an effort by Countrywide to continue sort of the cash flow of that business at the expense of the government. So they basically originated a ton of loans after the collapse of the subprime mortgage market and pawned them off to the government pursuant to the high-speed swim lane. Now, it is true that that case went before a jury and that the jury found that fraud had been committed, but that was ultimately overturned on appeal on a true legal technicality. The Court of Appeals had held that you need to show fraud not just at the time that the loans are sold to government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but you also have to show fraud and fraudulent intent at the very beginning of the contractual relationship. So they imposed this new requirement of sort of a double fraud. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the law evolves on that. It was certainly very novel and innovative. It was a new way to look at mail fraud and wire fraud laws that have been on the books for decades and decades. But the bottom line here is this. Those loans were not prime loans. The high-speed swim lane was designed to produce high-volume non-prime loans and package them as prime loans, and the jury so found. So regardless of the requirements of civil wire fraud and civil mail fraud, the real question is whether or not the government could have taken the evidence from that case and used it to either impose criminal accountability on the people who stood behind this effort to sell prime loans, to sell subprime loans as if they were prime loans, or even better, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, could have used these factual findings to impose regulatory sanctions on the financial sector, including breaking up these too big to fail, too big to jail mega banks that now have such a stranglehold on our government.
And yet, as listeners will recall, in the immediate aftermath of the crash in the fall of 2008, the banks that were still remaining gobbled up the ones that were falling apart. Is that correct?
Yeah, and so the reality of this is that any problems that can be attributed to the political and economic power that the financial sector held in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009 is now even worse because all of these banks have gotten bigger. As you said, in the aftermath of the crisis, they ended up having mergers and acquisitions involving teetering banks. And as a result, the degree of concentration in the financial sector today is higher than ever.
We'll get back to that in a few minutes. But let's continue on what I am looking at as conspiracy. And as an example, you mentioned the Goldman Sachs abacus program. Talk about that and how that actually pressured the subprime lenders to increase their already phenomenal volume and rapidity of giving out these loans. And what an ulterior motive appears to have been for doing that in terms of what's known as shorting this.
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the things that the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, led by Phil Angelides, found when investigating, and that's really the best investigation the government has undertaken with respect to what happened in the subprime debacle. One of the things they found was a consistent theme of people understanding that this was all unsustainable and that the system was going to collapse. And maybe one way of thinking about it is the financial system was blinking red. And a lot of people on the inside knew about that. So Angela Mozzillo, famously of Countrywide, had sent out an email to his senior executive staff that basically said some of the products they were selling were the most toxic loans he'd ever seen. he said, you know, there used to be banks that made loans like this, and they're all out of business today. So, I mean, he knew that this was not a viable business plan over the long term. And you know, he had the understanding of the risks that he was able to sell, according to the SEC in a civil enforcement action, over $100 million of Countrywide stock right before the collapse hit the public eye. And so, you know, that's just one example of what the FCIC had found in terms of financial sector insiders sort of seeing the train coming down the tracks. One thing that they found was in emails, they found an acronym, and they couldn't figure out what it was. And it stood for I'll Be Gone, You'll Be Gone. And so it was IBG, YBG. And the FCIC and the FCIC report found this on a repeated basis. So as a result, I don't think there's any question that by 2006, 2007, the financial sector sees that the collapse is coming. And so there's this, the people who really understand what's going on want to get short the mortgage market. They want to find a way to profit from mortgages defaulting. They want to be selling mortgage-backed securities so that when the price collapses, they are able to make money off the decline of the mortgage-backed securities that they're shorting. So the question is, how do you maintain a short position? How do you get a big short position and hold it long enough that when the collapse comes, you make a lot of money? And one thing that Wall Street ginned up on this front was something known as the Magnetar trade that is discussed at length in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report. And the Magnetar trade, which is very similar to the Abacus deal that went to a federal jury on securities fraud civil charges, where the jury found that securities fraud had occurred as a matter of civil law, not beyond a reasonable doubt, just by the preponderance of the evidence, was a deal that was structured so that it would fail and fail fast. So if you could imagine that you could come up with an investment vehicle and you could put the worst of the worst mortgages in that vehicle so that you knew that defaults were coming and that they would come quickly and figure out a way to get a short position on that vehicle, you could make a lot of money. And of course, AIG was in the business of issuing credit default swaps to all comers. So you go to AIG, you buy a credit default swap, and as a result, when the thing collapses, AIG pays you money because they have swapped the risk of default with you. Of course, you don't have a risk of default because you're just a pure short player or you're a net short player, and there's the big payoff. And that's why it was so important to Wall Street that the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government do whatever was necessary to keep AIG afloat so it could pay out on all those credit default swaps and keep all the people who had worked so hard to maintain short positions in the chips, because that was the big payday right there. When all those credit default swaps start getting paid, the people who were short these collateralized debt obligations, like the Abacus Fund or those in the Magnetar trade, really went to town and took in billions and billions of dollars.
It's very perplexing, as you write in the book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, in writing these credit default swap contracts with mega banks such as Goldman Sachs, etc., AIG actually wrote into the contract that Goldman Sachs would be the determiner of the value of the credit default swap should it fail. And this is very perplexing, is it not?
Well, it's extremely perplexing, but it works out very well for Goldman Sachs in terms of their ability to collect on these credit default swaps issued by AIG. You know, it's unclear. This is one of the major points that I want to emphasize to your listeners. There's a lot we know about the financial crisis 10 years on, But there's a lot we don't know. And if the government had actually investigated, if grand juries had been impaneled, if testimony had been taken and criminal actions were brought, like in the Enron series of crises and the savings and loan crises, we would know much more about the facts. So, for example, we know that that provision was in there. That provision that the people who determine whether or not collateral is due under the credit default swap agreements, we know it was in there. What we don't know is how it got there. And that's a really interesting question to me, because it's very, very odd that AIG would sit still for that. It's one of those things. It's one of the many, many facts of this crisis that really is screaming out for a real criminal investigation. But, you know, AIG's recovery, Goldman Sachs' recovery on those Goldman Sachs credit default swaps with AIG is billions and billions of dollars. And it was hard even for Congress to figure out exactly what the amount of those credit default swap payments to Goldman were. But that was probably the number one use of bailout funds to AIG, was paying off those credit default swaps.
Okay, so let's get back to the Department of Justice, the DOJ. You point out in your book that after the events of 9/11 in 2001, much of the resources of the Department of Justice were directed towards anti-terrorism efforts. However, in 2008, when President Obama was elected, and then in 2009, when Attorney General Eric Holder was confirmed, talk about Mr. Holder's background.
Well, Eric Holder is an extremely talented individual, and he had served in the DOJ previously before becoming Attorney General. Very highly respected individual. He was a partner at Covington & Burling, and he specializes in white-collar crime. So on some levels, Eric Holder is sort of the consummate insider. You know, he's a partner at a very high-profile, very prestigious Washington law firm. The Washington law firm, in fact, represents many major financial institutions. And he was put in place at the head of DOJ at the beginning of the Obama administration, and he simply did not make going after the mega banks a priority. Now, why that happened is really quite interesting. It's very difficult to explain why it happened, but it certainly happened. And he brought with him another partner from Covington and Burling, Lanny Brewer, who was the head of the criminal division at Goldman Sachs. Now, these folks have made some very interesting comments over the years. One of the comments that Eric Holder made that I thought was really interesting was the comment at the very beginning of my book, where I talk about, I have a direct quote of his congressional testimony where he says the following. He says, I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications it will have a negative impact on the economy. That's March 6, 2013, before Congress. So that's a very curious comment from a sitting attorney general. You know, the attorney general is not designed, that position is not institutionally designed to be chief economics officer of the United States. The attorney general of the United States is not institutionally equipped to make decisions on things like systemic risk as a result of fraud in the financial sector. That is not in his job description. And in terms of being hit with indications that it could have fallout for the economy to pursue certain criminal allegations, I'm just completely befuddled at what he's talking about. Who hit him with these indications? What is their background? Why don't we have public disclosure of that, their identity? Are there other people out there who may hit him with counterindications? Did they look for people who may hit him with counterindications? None of this is disclosed. There's no transparency here. It's very, very difficult to find the source of this idea that we've been hit with indications that the economy is going to suffer if we enforce laws that have been on the books for decades and decades and decades against fraud, against bank fraud, against securities fraud, against wire fraud and mail fraud. So now let's take a step back from these indications that the economy is going to suffer. We make the argument in our book based on historic facts that every time the financial sector is overrun with fraud, bad things happen to the economy. People lose their jobs, the economy contracts, and the government is forced to expend massive resources to come and clean up the mess. And so Congress has made a decision, and they made this decision on a bipartisan basis for decades and decades and decades. There is no place for fraud in the financial sector. You see it in the Federal Reserve Act. You see it in the regulatory powers of the Federal Reserve. You see it in the FDIC regulatory powers. You see it in the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency's powers with respect to national banks. You see it in the Securities and Exchange Commission's powers from the 34 Act and the regulatory power that they have to address fraud in the financial sector. And yet all of these laws are not used at all for the crisis of 2007-2008. It's extremely odd, and the only explanation we've been able to come up with as a former SEC enforcement attorney, as a former FDIC senior attorney, and my wife Mary, as a former DOJ prosecutor, the only explanation we can come up with is it's all about concentrated political and economic power. I don't think that it hurts the economy to enforce the rule of law when it comes to fraud. I think it hurts the economy to not enforce those rules and to create perverse incentives in our financial sector. That simply is not a good way to run your financial sector.
Professor Ramirez, in your book, you do point out the civil penalties that various corporations have had to pay. But you also point out the individuals who actually committed the fraud, allegedly, because these have not been proven in a court of law.
They don't
get penalized. It's actually their shareholders, and their shareholders have already suffered from the crisis itself. Could you expand on that and perhaps give some examples of these sorts of settlements?
Yes. I think basically the way that a corporation works is it's supposed to be run for the benefit of the shareholders. And the managers are in a position of trust and confidence vis-a-vis the shareholders, who, after all, are investing their hard-earned cash in the corporation in hopes that it's going to pay off long term. This is a core function in a modern capitalistic economy. The ability of the corporation to channel cash into the corporation from passive investors means that money doesn't sit on the sidelines. It's used to fund expansionary activities like innovation and building new factories and whatever the corporation does with the capital. But the idea is that the disclosure to the shareholders is, look, you give us your money and we will operate this thing on your behalf and for your long-term wealth maximization, and you are the residual claimant of all of our assets and profits. Anything that's left after we pay off our creditors goes to you. This is very important. It's a very important contract that shareholders have with corporations that they invest in. Now, when a corporation cuts a check to cover fraudulent activities by its underlings, it is, in essence, taking the residue that belongs to the shareholders and redirecting it to the government in order to protect its own people inside the corporation. And honestly, I don't think that makes much sense. I think that it's very important that when people commit fraud, they pay the costs of their fraud and whatever criminal penalties go on top of that and whatever regulatory penalties go on top of that, whether that means the breakup of the bank where the fraud has occurred or the career death penalty for those who committed the fraud. Unfortunately, what we saw in this crisis was boatloads of shareholder money going out the door in order to resolve claims of fraud at these mega banks, and virtually no accountability by any senior executive officer. So I think one example of this is Angelo Mozzillo at Countrywide. Angelo Mozzillo settled with the SEC for tens of millions of dollars. But the problem is he made hundreds of millions of dollars as CEO of Countrywide, and he made over $100 million selling stock of Countrywide at the last minute before its collapse. And in the end, the only thing that came out of his pocket was $20 million. So there it is. There it is. It is the announcement that in America, in the financial sector, you can retain hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation and in proceeds of fraud and only pay de minimis penalties, civil penalties in exchange, and keep hundreds of millions of dollars in your pocket. And when you consider, you said at the opening of the show, when you consider the losses of everyone in our society, from people who were foreclosed upon to people who lost their job, $20 trillion in foregone GDP is a mind-boggling number. To allow that to happen is irrational, and it bespeaks a system of law that has been deeply subverted from a rule of law point of view. And it's simply something that we need to address as a society, or keep your checkbooks out, folks, because you can expect to pay more money going forward for this kind of nonsense.
All right, back to the DOJ and their creative ways of addressing this. There are two things. There is the deferred prosecution agreement and a non-prosecution agreement with some of these mega banks. Let's talk about what they are and how they differ and how they have been used.
So a deferred prosecution agreement is the idea that we will not prosecute now so long as you engage in certain behavior, and the deferral can become permanent. A non-prosecution agreement is we will not prosecute you if you do X, Y, and Z. Now, unfortunately, the reality of these agreements is that it's very rare that DOJ ever comes back and says, look, it's time now. You didn't do what you promised to do. You violated more laws. Whatever the case may be, we're going to bring a criminal action against you. That just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen very often. I don't know how often it's happened, but it's very rare. In the financial sector, now you've gotten to a level of rarity that is mind-boggling. For the most part, these institutions, the big ones, right? Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, they have the ability to just violate laws again and again and again and never really pay the piper in terms of the wrongdoers who are involved in the wrongdoing having to face accountability. So you can talk about things like the London whale trade. You can talk about things at Chase. You can talk about things like the way the currency markets had been rigged or the manipulation of LIBOR. It always seems to come out the same in the financial sector. Money might be paid for civil penalties, shareholder money, innocent shareholder money, because shareholders, by definition, don't have anything to do with the operation of the corporation. And the wrongdoers get off scot-free, and they end up not paying really anything out of their own pockets. And this creates very perverse incentives. Any economist will tell you that these kinds of perverse incentives lead to more misconduct, more bad conduct, and ultimately more cost to our economy.
Now, although the average citizen in the United States probably doesn't have a very sophisticated knowledge of the specifics of the crash, the government bailout. They have a sense, and it was reflected in the latest election, that the fat cats on Wall Street got away scot-free. The little guy paid for it. The little guy got screwed. And they're mad as hell, and they're not going to take it anymore. Many observers say that it's this sort of sentiment that now gives us a Trump administration. And in fact, Donald Trump on the campaign trail was very vocal against Wall Street. He used Hillary Clinton's and her family's connections to Wall Street, the millions they have gotten in speaker fees, the donations to the Clinton Foundation, those sorts of things. And whatever else may have been part of Hillary Clinton's background, many believe that that was the ultimate thing that caused Donald Trump to be our current president. Are you equipped to speak to how his campaign promises are playing out in the early days of his administration, particularly in terms of the people he's appointing to his administration?
Well, it's a very good question. I would like to think that the Trump administration, which did in fact argue that change needed to be made in Washington, that the swamp needed to be drained, and that Hillary Clinton was not the right person for that job, is in fact going to do that now. I am discouraged by the fact that our Secretary of Treasury, once again, is a former Goldman Sachs employee. I am discouraged that our Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is not necessarily viewed as one of the most strong anti-bank voices that could have been in that position. And, you know, the statute of limitations on this stuff is 10 years. Congress was very serious about stopping fraud in the financial sector, and so it's got a very long statute of limitations. But those statute of limitations are ticking as we speak, and deadlines are coming up relatively soon in terms of misconduct that occurred in 2007 now. And it would be nice to think that the Trump administration is going to finally cause the government to take the action that the government should take here. But frankly, I'm not optimistic based on early indications. I'm not optimistic based on the reality that this is fundamentally bipartisan, that I could probably speak for 15 minutes straight, if you would like, Joy, on how the Democrats contributed to this mess. And then I could turn around and speak for 15 minutes straight on how the Republicans contributed to this mess. I don't really think that the financial crisis and the breakdown in the rule of law can be blamed on either party, because it is, in fact, a problem with our political system in general. And one of the things that I think is a real shame about this crisis is that because we are so divided as citizens in the United States, and because this partisan divide is so deep, there really is precious little wisdom on exactly what happened and what needs to be done to fix it in our political discourse. So I paid very close attention to the political campaign. And I listened to what Donald Trump said, and I listened to what Hillary Clinton said. I never heard either one of them say, we're going to crack down on Wall Street. We're going to impose accountability on the wrongdoing that led to the financial crisis, and we're going to make sure it never happened again. I just didn't hear that. So I'm not optimistic in the end about what's going to happen during the Trump administration. And that's a real shame, because I think we still have time to impose the disincentives that we need to impose in terms of fraud on Wall Street.
Now, many people have been critical of the Dodd-Frank bill on both sides. Those who wanted more regulation feel it didn't go far enough. Those who want total deregulation say it went too far. But in particular, I wonder if you could speak about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Senator Elizabeth Warren is famous for having promoted that. Ted Cruz has actually introduced a bill that would abolish the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Could you please address those issues?
Well, I think Elizabeth Warren has consistently been a rational voice for regulation that makes sense. And I think the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a good example of that. One of the things that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has done is it's really made it difficult to sell mortgages to public investors that are toxic mortgages. In order to be a qualifying home loan, certain criteria needs to be met, and that criteria mirrors the kind of underwriting criteria that banks used for decades and decades and decades to make safe home loans that provided housing to people over the long term and never caused a major financial collapse. So this idea that we're going to crack down on predatory lending and that we're going to make it so that securitized loans are actually safe and sound loans and not reckless toxic loans, it's a good idea. It makes sense. It's time tested. And in fact, when you think about Dodd-Frank in general, it's been on the books now since 2010. I have criticized it in various publications that I have put out since 2010, but one thing that you can't argue with about Dodd-Frank, it has prevented a repeat of the crisis of 2007-2008. So as a law professor, I would have to say that it is a material improvement over the legal and regulatory infrastructure that governed the financial sector in 2006-2007, and it is a reason why today, 2017, the economy is still on the mend, slowly but surely. And so I think it would be really, really reckless to repeal Dodd-Frank or scuttle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, the question is, how much do you want to go back to 2007? If you want to go back to 2007, as a law professor, I can tell you exactly how to do it. First thing to do would be repeal Dodd-Frank. And frankly, I think the risk that you run is that you get 2007 laws and regulation, you get a 2020 crisis that may be even worse than 2007 because these banks are bigger than ever.
We are running very low on time, and of course I have way more things I want to ask you. But Matt Taibbi wrote an article in early January headlined, Trump nominee Jay Clayton will be the most conflicted SEC chair ever. That's the Securities and Exchange Commission ever. He talks about he represented Goldman Sachs when the firm received $5 billion capital infusion from Warren Buffett. On and on. He's married to a high-level executive in Goldman Sachs. This brings up the whole conflict of interest problem that we're seeing in so many levels, from President Trump himself, his family, on down to many members of his administration. Do you have any comments on these sorts of issues?
Well, I think we need to get used to this, honestly. One of the points that I made in Lawless Capitalism is there's a reason why the subversion of law and regulation occurred in 2005, 2006, 2007, and the years before that, rather than in the 1960s or 70s or even the early 80s. And the reason is that economists will tell you that when you get more money concentrated in fewer hands, collective action like lobbying is facilitated. And the idea of free riders hoping someone else will attend to the lobbying begins to dissipate, because the more concentration you have in wealth, the more likely it is everyone will see it in their interest to participate in lobbying our politicians in Washington, D.C. Well, inequality in the United States, particularly at the very top level of the 0.01% of the income distribution, has soared over the last 30 years. And that means that there's more money in fewer hands. So as long as that's the case, we're going to have to reckon with the fact that our politicians are going to be easily distracted by all kinds of political largesse that can be provided to them by the most wealthy in our society. So any laws we put in place with respect to conflicts of interest and any high-level appointments that are going to be made are always, under those circumstances, I would suggest, going to be somewhat tainted by this fundamental conflict of interest between the interests of the most powerful in our society and the interest of our society as a whole. In other words, very high economic inequality leads to the subversion of the rule of law. And that's what we saw in the run-up to the subprime crisis, and it's what we saw in the aftermath of the subprime crisis. And both of my books, both of my first book, Lawless Capitalism, and the book that I wrote with Professor Mary Ramirez, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, document that in great detail.
Well, with that, we're going to have to leave it there. I very much regret to say that we are out of time now. Thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, Professor Stephen A. Ramirez.
Thank you, Joy. I really enjoyed our discussion.
Yes, I did as well. Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Stephen A. Ramirez, Associate Dean at the Business Law Center at Loyola University School of Law. We've been discussing his latest book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street, co-written with his wife, Mary Kreiner Ramirez, who is Professor of Law at Washburn University School of Law. It's just been published by New York University Press. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each and first third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LaClaire, and you can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com.